I would remind you, Mr. Martin, that your transcript will be made public. If for some reason you wish to make a confidential statement during today's proceedings, you should request that the evidence be taken in private session. If the committee grants your request, any public and media in attendance will be excluded from the hearing. Until such time as the transcript of your public evidence is finalised, it should not be made public. I advise you that publication or disclosure of the uncorrected transcript of evidence may constitute a contempt of Parliament and may mean that material published or disclosed is not subject to parliamentary privilege. Would you like to make an opening statement to the committee?
Yes, look, just very briefly, thanks, Chair. I hope my submission, my written submission, didn't create the impression that I'm opposed to jury trials, because I'm not. I'm a great supporter of jury trials. I think the community involvement and engagement which they provide is of great value to the justice system and enormously important for that system. And I think jury trials should and always will remain the overwhelmingly dominant means of determining guilt in the more serious cases in Western Australia. Quite irrespective of this bill and its terms, because I don't think the bill will have a significant impact on that, and I think that's a good thing. My support for the bill really derives from the weight and importance which I give to reasoned and transparent justice. And because of that weight, I think an accused person should be able to obtain that form of justice effectively by election, unless in the particular circumstances of the case, that form of justice would be contrary to the interests of justice as a whole. And I'll come back perhaps in the answer to questions as to the very limited circumstances in which I think that might be the case. The advantage of reasoned justice is, the advantages of reasoned justice, I think, are many. They include improving the quality of decision making. I think the obligation of providing a written statement of reasons imposes a discipline on a decision maker to adopt a logical and rational approach to the decision-making process, which can be demonstrated to the public. Having written more than 500 reasons for decision in the course of my judicial career, I'm personally experienced with the benefits of that discipline. I think it does undoubtedly improve the quality of decision-making. It also improves transparency, so that the public and those interested in the case are given a full explanation of the reasons for the decision, whereas at the moment, a jury's verdict is entirely opaque and there is no reasoning at all available. The reason justice also creates a meaningful right of appeal, so that the right of appeal relates to the merits of the case, whether there has been errors in decisions of fact or law. There's a full range of issues that can be canvassed in an appeal, whereas an appeal from a jury verdict effectively can only be brought by the accused, not the prosecution, and there is no capacity to go behind the verdict of the jury and ascertain whether it was justified or not. There are only very, very limited circumstances in which the court can ever do that. And another advantage of trial by judge alone and the reasons which are provided is that the right of appeal is bilateral. It's not unilateral, so that both sides have a right of appeal, and that right of appeal is meaningful. And so essentially for those reasons, I support the bill, which would effectively confer an election upon an accused person to elect to have trial by judge alone in all but a limited class of exceptional cases. So that's all I wish to say by way of opening. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. A number of points you've made are things that we want to take up with you in questioning, sure, that you won't be surprised about. So I might just work straight through them. My colleagues, as always, are welcome to jump in. Perhaps you could just signal by giving me your name so that Mr. Martin knows who's speaking to him. So let's make a start. Mr. Martin, in your submission, you note that the workload implications for judges as a result of the measures proposed by the bill would not be significant. Do you think there's any risk of the proportion of trials by judge alone in Western Australia increasing to levels previously experienced in South Australia and the ACT?
No, I don't. The ACT is a very unusual jurisdiction, so I discount entirely the experience there. It's very unusual demographically. It has obviously a much greater proportion of middle class than most other areas of jurisdiction, and that influences the nature of crime. And it's got a slightly different court system, because effectively you have a Supreme Court and a Magistrates Court and nothing in between. So I wouldn't take any place any reliance on what happened in the ACT. South Australia is much closer, of course, by comparison. But in Western Australia, there hasn't been great enthusiasm for trial by judge alone. And the best example of that, I think, is in the current circumstances, because as committee members are probably aware, in the light of the virus, jury trials have been suspended indefinitely. Both Supreme and District Courts have made it clear to accused people that in these circumstances, they will be take a much more favourable approach towards any application for trial by judge alone, on the basis that it will enable justice to be dispensed more quickly, and that's in the interests of justice, whereas obviously after this there's going to be a very substantial backlog of jury trials awaiting trial. Despite the court making that clear, loud and clear, throughout the profession, I understand the take-up has been very low indeed, and so very few people have actually opted for trial by judge alone. The conventional view, whether it's accurate or not, but the conventional view, I think, amongst the legal profession is that there is more chance of acquittal in a trial by jury than in a trial by judge alone. Now, whether or not that stacks up against the evidence, I don't know, but I think that is the conventional view, and for that reason, I think most lawyers will be advising clients, if you've got a choice between trial by judge alone and trial by jury, go for the jury every time. Conversely, the people who will want trial by judge alone are people who believe they have a strong defence and who want to see that defence properly enunciated in the reasons of the court, or who have suffered significant adverse pretrial publicity, or where the case involves complex issues of expert evidence. They're the sort of cases in which people want trial by judge alone. Those cases are relatively rare, and so I don't think the bill would have any significant impact on the numbers. There'd be a few more, but we're talking about handfuls of cases in any event, so I don't think we'd see anything like those numbers.
Thank you. In your submission, you note that, and I'm quoting here, however liberal the availability of trial by judge alone, the vast majority of the accused will elect trial by jury because of the forensic advantages which that means of trial offers to an accused. Could you elaborate on what you mean by the forensic advantages of trial by jury?
Sure. The first forensic advantage is the one I mentioned, and that is the perception that a jury is more likely to acquit than a judge. A jury is more likely to take into account circumstances that might be regarded as extraneous by a judge. Sympathy, emotion, those sort of things are more likely to influence a jury in their decision than a judge. The other forensic advantage, of course, is that the standard of proof in criminal cases beyond reasonable doubt. A lot of defences are conducted on the basis that there is a reasonable doubt, irrespective of whether the jury thinks the accused might have committed the offence, they must entertain a reasonable doubt. And so a lot of defence strategies, not a lot, but sometimes, not uncommonly, the defence strategy is to create doubt, to create confusion, complexity and doubt in the hope that the jury will think, well, we don't know what the answer is, but I do have a doubt, therefore I acquit. That type of defence strategy is much harder to maintain in front of a judge, because a judge will reason through whether or not there is a doubt. So it's really those aspects. Juries tend to take a much broader brush approach to the questions of guilt or innocence. These are massive generalisations. Of course, some juries are very painstaking and very detailed, but some aren't. And so I think the conventional view is that an accused person, generally speaking, has got a better chance in front of a jury than in front of a judge.
Proposed amendments have the effect of increasing the number of trials by judge alone. Would additional judicial resources be required to enable judges to prepare adequate reasons for their decisions?
I don't think so. My view is that the differences between trial by jury and trial by judge alone would probably be time and cost neutral. And let me try and explain. This will be a lengthy answer, I'm afraid, but it's recurrent in a lot of the questions of which I was given notice, so I'll take a bit of time to explain this. Jury trials generally take a lot longer than trials by judge alone, and I'll surely explain why. The difference is that at the end of a jury trial, you have a verdict, whereas at the end of a judge alone trial, the judge has to go off and write reasons. The reasons jury trials take longer is the various steps in the process. And just starting from the beginning, there's the process of jury empanelment, which usually takes between an hour and an hour and a half. Depending upon upon the nature of the case. Now, in a long trial, that's a relatively small proportion of the time. In a short trial, say a 2 or 3 day trial, that's quite a lengthy proportion of the total trial time. In addition, because you've got a jury, you take morning and afternoon tea breaks, a quarter of an hour in each case, but it usually takes about 20 minutes to get the jury in and out of court. So there's 40 minutes gone in morning and afternoon tea breaks, which are not taken when the trial is by judge alone. Given that the normal sitting day is 5 hours, that's a bit over 10% of the day is lost just in tea breaks. When you've got a jury, you can't sit longer days because your jurors have commitments that they have to meet, family commitments and the like, and their attention span is limited, and I think that's recognised. So judges sitting alone can go on longer if it's needed. At the end of a jury trial, of course, you have the judge addressing the jury. That varies from case to case. The longer the case, the longer the directions, but generally it's between an hour and 2 hours in which the judge directs the jury, which, of course, you don't have in trial by judge alone. Jurors sometimes get sick or otherwise can't serve, and if you don't have adequate reserves, then that can lead to the trial being aborted. But perhaps most significantly of all is the way in which evidence has to be presented, so that in a trial by jury, all the evidence must be presented in open court, and it must be presented orally, and it must be explained in simple terms to the jury. So that, for example, if the parties agree that a witness's statement can be presented without the witness being called because defence, for example, doesn't want to cross-examine, you still have to read the statement to the jury in open court, and you have to tender all the documents. And the expert evidence, when it's given, for example, DNA evidence, it has to always start with a lengthy explanation to the jury of what DNA is, and that usually takes half to three quarters of an hour so they can understand it, whereas judges have heard that explanation many times. They can take that as given, and a lot of the evidence can just go straight to it. In a judge-alone trial, the witness statements won't be read in open court. They'll just be handed up to the judge, who then reads them in chambers. And in the Rainey case, which was a lengthy trial by judge alone, certainly over 100, I think close to 200 statements were handed up to the judge. And the perception is that that saved an awful lot of time. And indeed, talking to people involved in that trial, the estimate is that perhaps between 1 and 2 months of trial time was saved in that case because the trial was by judge alone rather than by jury. There's also, of course, the risk in any jury trial that the jury will be hung in the sense that they won't be able to arrive at a decision, which leads you to a retrial. I think if you sum all those things together, the time savings in a trial by judge alone would approximately equal the time taken by a judge to write reasons. In terms of sheer cost, leaving aside time and moving to cost, of course, you save the cost of paying for the jurors. So that in any jury trial, you have to bring the panel along, which is more than the people in panel in the jury. Some of those people won't be selected, but you still have to pay them for the day that they've lost turning up. And then you will normally impanel some reserve jurors, so you might have, say, 14 in an ordinary case. You've got to replace the earnings lost by those 14 people throughout the trial, and that's quite a big sum of money. So if you want to view it from a purely economic perspective, I think if anything, it'd be either neutral or there would be savings to the state in running trial by judge alone rather than by jury. And certainly in big trials, like the Rainey case I mentioned, the Edwards case that's running at the moment, those savings would be very significant indeed. So that each of those cases would have been much more expensive, much more precarious too, because if you run out of jurors through a case of 3 or 4 or 5 months duration, and for some reason you have to abandon the case and start again, that is horrendously expensive. And there's really very little risk of that in trial by judge alone. So I think in terms of time and cost, my view is that the two systems are comparable in terms of the net cost to the state, net amount of judicial time. If anything, I'd say trial by judge alone probably saves a little time and saves a little money as well.
Do my colleagues have any supplementary questions at this stage?
Yes, Chairman, it's Nick Goran here. I'd like to follow up on this. This is an important area of our inquiry, and I thank Mr. Martin for that explanation. The difficulty I've got at the moment in rationalising this particular element of our inquiry is that everything that you've said just in answer to this question makes an incredible amount of sense. However, it is the complete opposite to what we were told by Chief Justice Quinlan and Chief Judge Slight, although I think he may have since retired. And I just want to take you to the extract of the hearing we had with Chief Justice Quinlan in particular, because he appeared before us with the Chief Judge, although the Chief Judge's remarks, according to my notes, were simply, "I have nothing to add, I agree with everything the Chief Justice has said." So what Mr. Quinlan said was, he said, "I will go first, I do not agree with that statement." And the statement was, "Do you agree that an increase in that an increase in judge alone trials would save our court's time?" He says, "I will go first. I do not agree with that statement. In fact, I would be quite sure that the time required to complete a case would be substantially longer. There are some aspects of a trial involving the jury that would not have to occur in a trial by judge alone. One is the very beginning of the trial, which is the opening, the jury impanelment process, and the judge's introductory remarks to the jury. That, in my experience, takes about an hour. The other aspect would be the judge's direction to the jury at the close of the trial, which can be between 1 and 5 or 6 hours, depending upon the length of the trial. Sometimes, in a significantly longer trial, it might be longer than that. But as you would understand, any jury direction that required more than a couple of hours would be in a trial that is itself already 2 or 3 weeks long. Those would be the adjustments in the time of trial, but then there would be a significant addition to the judge's writing time that would need to be accommodated. Having spoken to the judges of the court, those who have actually conducted these trials, the shortest period of time it takes to put together reasons is 4 days. It can take a lot longer. But there would not be a saving of time in that regard. I should say this in relation to the differences between the jury trial and a judge-alone trial, which we all have experience of in the civil sphere. Jury trials tend to be more disciplined than trials by judge-alone, because all of the participants, the lawyers and the judges, are conscious of the fact that they are working to a time schedule with a jury. In a trial by judge-alone, be it civil or criminal, it is not uncommon, for example, for a day to be in lieu because the lawyers wish to look into some issue or matter of that kind. So it is not necessarily a like-for-like comparison in terms of the actual running of the trial in court, but certainly it is the additional writing time that would increase substantially the judge time required. Now, I'm sorry to have taken period of time to set that out, but I just thought it was helpful, and I found... like your explanation this morning, Mr. Mann, I found also the explanation provided by Mr. Quinlan quite compelling. And there's a lot of similarities between what the two of you have said. But I just would particularly invite any comment you have to make about his remarks. If you might just comment about his comment about the length of time that it would take to actually write the decisions.
Well, can I just say, it seems to me from listening to what you're saying, the differences between us are that, and of course I respect his honest view, the difference between us is he's made no allowances for the morning and afternoon breaks, which, as I say, take up more than 10% of the hearing time. But most significantly of all, he's made no allowance for the difference in the speed at which the evidence can be presented. And in my experience in trials, there, the speed with which the evidence can be presented is vastly different in the two areas. So that in a long trial, as I say, the Edwards and the Rainey cases, I would expect the time savings to be measured in terms of months rather than hours or days. In terms of the issue of discipline, with respect, I don't know that's judges can and should be disciplined in the way in which they conduct their trials. I don't think that's a reason for saying that one system would be more... The fact that judges tend to be undisciplined doesn't seem to me to be a very cogent reason for saying that one system is more efficient than the other. But I don't accept it anyway. I mean, certainly those who appeared in front of me would have had been left in no doubt that the trial would be moving forward in accordance with the schedule that was fixed by the court. In terms of writing, again, it depends upon the length of the case. I don't think a minimum of 4 days would be my estimate, because judges have to give directions to juries at the end of any trial. And that means when you're a trial judge, and of course I've conducted many trials as a judge, each night I think most judges do this, you carry out an evidence summary. So that in my case, I would do it by dictating something that I would send to my PA from wherever I was around Western Australia, and she'd type that up the next day and I'd have it by lunchtime. So that you've got the evidence summary, which you then use for your directions to the jury. Now, the directions to the jury, which you give at the end of the case, are in effect a review of all the issues of fact and law in the case. Now, often with judges, they will not be so detailed about their factual address to the jury, but the facts will be there because they'll have the transcript and they'll have their evidence summaries, which they've usually performed. So it's then a question of really converting what would otherwise have been the task of directing the jury with respect to the legal issues, taking the factual summaries that you've produced and then converting them into reasons for decision. Now, I would have thought in a short trial, 2 or 3 days, that's not going to take 4 days. I would have thought that could be done in a day or two at most. In a longer trial, it's obviously going to take longer. But in a longer trial, the time savings are also much likely to be much greater. So I think that's a neat summary of the differences between our respective views.
Yes, thank you very much.
Good.
Okay, let's move on. So question four is, what types of cases are typically tried by judge alone under the current system? And in your view, are those trials generally shorter than they would be if tried by jury? And what are the reasons for that?
Well, I think I've already answered the last part of your question. I think they are generally shorter for the reasons I've given. The types of cases that go for trial by judge alone at the moment are cases in which they turn substantially on expert evidence, most commonly what used to be called cases involving fitness to plead or the defence of mental impairment or insanity, where the evidence is entirely psychiatric. It will commonly be conducted by judge alone, and because they're just expert evidence cases, they'll be conducted very quickly. The other category of case which is now conducted by judge alone is cases and is cases in which there's been significant adverse pretrial publicity. And the two I've mentioned, Rainey and Edwards, are good examples of those, and there have been others where the perception is that the extent of the pretrial publicity has been such that obtaining a jury who could bring a completely free and impartial mind to bear upon the issue is difficult. There have been other cases in which the nature of the evidence, there's one case involving a terrible murder of an infant, an Aboriginal infant in the north, where the judge took the view that the nature of the evidence was so emotionally gut-wrenching that it would have an impact, an adverse impact on the jury from the perspective of the accused. That's really, I think, the main. Another example of the pretrial publicity case was the Pace reported in this morning's paper, a sexual offence case involving the so-called Evil Eight. So there are a number of examples of those sorts of cases, but they tend to be the cases in which trial by judge alone is used at the moment.
Thank you. If the bill were to result in an increase in the number of trials by judge alone, would you expect the additional trials to represent a similar distribution of offences to that currently dealt with by the courts, or would applicants charged with certain offences be more likely to apply for a trial by judge alone?
No, I think you'd see much the same as you do at the moment. That is, that the cases would be cases in which there was a perception that the jury may not be able to bring an impartial mind to bear, because otherwise, as I say, the conventional view is that people would rather take their chances in front of a jury. I think also you would tend to see, as you do at the moment, that the cases would be more towards the serious end of the spectrum rather than the minor end of the spectrum, so that the lawyers advising the accused would probably only opt for trial by judge alone in the more serious end, simply because there are some there is some reluctance amongst lawyers to go for trial by judge alone as well, because it exposes them to perhaps greater scrutiny. They have to work a bit harder in terms of fully presenting their cases to the judge in a way that will find favour in the reasons of the judge. So my guess would be it'd be pretty much the same, but there will be a bias, I think, towards the more serious end of the criminal spectrum.
Thank you. We come now to the question about the presumed rights. So our question is, as Chief Justice, you wrote a number of decisions about whether an accused person applying for trial by judge alone has a presumed right to trial by jury or trial by judge alone. Do you have a view about how this would work under the new test?
Yeah, well, my view on the legislation as it currently is was that there was no preferment to be discerned from the terms of the legislation. That is, there was no presumptive position in favour of trial by jury that had to be displaced by some kind of exceptional circumstance. In other words, I read the Act as creating an even field and for the judge to determine where the interests of justice lay. It was my view that in ordinary cases, the desire of an accused person for trial by judge alone, and therefore the provision of reasons and a full right of appeal, was a significant factor in favour of the interests of justice. And so my view was that when an accused person wanted trial by judge alone, unless there were strong countervailing factors under the current legislation, that would very often lead to the conclusion that it was in the interests of justice for the person to be tried that way. That wasn't the majority view. Colleagues took a different view, including in a case in the Court of Appeal. So that view hasn't prevailed. I think that would essentially be the position under this legislation, so that there would, in effect, be a right of an accused person to elect trial by judge alone that would only be displaced if the court took a view that it was contrary to the interests of justice. I think under the bill, the occasions upon which a court would arrive at that conclusion would be pretty limited.
In your submission, you say that you do not subscribe to the theory that juries always get their decisions right. Do you think there should be a comprehensive review of whether trial by jury should continue in Western Australia?
No, I don't. I hope that observation wasn't misunderstood. It was really a counter to the proposition. I've heard experienced judges say juries always get it right. Juries are infallible. I don't subscribe to that view. I'm not saying, and indeed the view is, that view is contradicted by the evidence. There have been, as I point out in my submission, there have been a number of cases in Western Australia and elsewhere in which we know that the jury has got it wrong for one reason or another. Mallard's the classic example, and there have been many others, unfortunately. So all I'm saying is that you can't start from the presumption that juries are invariably right. But I don't think the error rate is so high as to put the system in great doubt. And I think, as I said earlier in my opening statement, the advantage of community involvement is a very powerful advantage. So I wouldn't think there's reason to upset the, you know, to review the whole process generally.
Yeah, you did make that clear in your opening statement.
Yeah.
We come now to the question about appeals. In the second reading speech, it suggested that an increase in judge alone trials would cut down on appeals. Do you think that's right? And
no.
Can you give your reasons?
No, I don't agree with that. What it would do, I think, is alter the nature of appeals in two material respects. Criminal appeals, as I tried to point out in my submissions, and I sat on many of them, criminal appeals are very unusual appeals because you don't have any reasons to review. Invariably, it's an appeal against conviction because the state can't appeal against an acquittal. They don't have any reasons. So the law has, there's some kind of surrogate for the reasons has emerged in the form of the trial judge's directions to the jury. So in other words, in order to upset the conviction, basically with one small exceptional category of case to which I'll come, to upset the conviction, you have to show a defect in process. You don't have to, and so the appeals are not brought on the basis the decision was wrong. The appeals are brought, except for the exceptional category to which I've come, the appeals are brought on the basis that there was a defect in process. And the most common defect in process is an allegation that the trial judge made an error in the directions to the jury. So what that results in is the appeals then, the directions to the jury become a kind of a surrogate for the reasons of the jury, because there are no reasons for the jury. And then the Court of Appeal pours over the directions given to the jury as almost as if they are the reasons of the jury and looks for error in those directions. And sometimes that comes down to quite minute and detailed scrutiny of particular words and phrases, which always seem to me to give them an importance well beyond, in the appeal process, give an importance well beyond the importance that they really carry in a trial environment. Having directed many juries, I know that they're not hanging on every word that I say. I know that they're not involved in a minute scrutiny of phrases and words and the sequence in which they're put. That's just not how juries work, but that's how courts of appeal work. By contrast, where you've got reasons, there is a full review of the findings of fact, a full review of the application of the principles of law, and therefore the appeal performs the normal process of providing a full review of what actually of the decision, not just the process, but the merits of the decision. Now, the one exception, slight exception to that, is that there is this category of appeal to the effect that the verdict of the jury was unsafe and unsatisfactory. That is to say that no reasonable jury could have arrived at the conclusion of guilt. The question there is not whether the jury should have found the person guilty. The question is whether the jury could have found the person guilty. So in other words, the question is not whether the jury should have entertained a reasonable doubt, but whether the jury must have entertained a reasonable doubt. Now, that sets the hurdle very, very high. It was a hurdle that was crossed recently in the Pell decision in the High Court. If you read that decision, you'll see the court reaffirmed that the question is not what the jury should have done, but what the jury could have done. So it's not a full review on the merits in the sense that the court reviews whether the jury was right or wrong. It's whether the jury, in fact, could only have arrived at one conclusion. As I said, in my 12 years on the court, including a lot of time on the Court of Criminal Appeal, a lot of appeals were brought on that ground. Only one ever succeeded, and that was the Martinez case involving the death of Philip Walsham, who was thrown from the footbridge onto the freeway. And that appeal succeeded on that ground because there was uncontradicted evidence, objective evidence, that cast doubt on the prosecution case. That's a very unusual case. In almost all cases, appeals on that ground are dismissed. So I think there would probably be more appeals, but you'd have the appeals would be more effective so that they would actually address the real question, which is whether the accused person was guilty or innocent, and not the question of whether the trial process miscarried.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. I think you've already answered question 9, but I'll ask it just in case there's anything you feel you need to add. The committee has received submissions that the requirement to prepare reasons in a trial by a judge alone will enhance the quality of the criminal justice system, as any possible errors can be identified in the reasons and fully reviewed by an appellate court. Do you agree with that statement? Why or why not?
Well, I do agree with that for the reasons I've just given. The other aspect to that, I think, is the one I've already mentioned, and that is the provision of reasons enhances is a very dramatic step forward in the path of transparency. And the Pell case is a good example of this. Because trial for Judge Alone wasn't available in Victoria, Cardinal Pell was tried by a jury. I suspect that in any other jurisdiction where trial by Judge Alone was available, the extent of the pretrial publicity would have been such that he would have been tried by Judge Alone. The consequence of being tried by a jury was that when the verdict came out, as you will recall, there was an awful lot of speculation, mainly in the media, about the jury's verdict. A lot of commentators said the jury's verdict was unreasonable, but there was no basis for the public forming any view as to whether that proposition was right or wrong, because the jury's verdict was entirely opaque and inscrutable. So far from enhancing the public's impression of the justice system, I think the opacity of the verdict in that case really diminished the public's view of the justice system. And of course, that was compounded when more than a year later, the High Court came out and said, well, the jury could not have permissibly arrived at that conclusion. But we'll never know why the jury did arrive at that conclusion. So I think not only does it expand the right of appeal, but also that the transparency that it provides a very important aspect of improving the public perception of the justice system.
Thank you. Likewise, with question 10, in your submission, you note that directions of a trial judge are subject to minute analysis in the Court of Appeal, with the result that trial judges are giving more detailed and complex directions to juries. Do you think there should be law reform in this area?
Yes, I do. As has happened in Victoria, some years ago, Victoria, through its Law Reform Commission, launched a project on simplifying jury directions. I think the problem is that because of the decisions of the High Court in particular, some of the directions which trial judges have to give to juries are very complex and frankly incomprehensible. An example that jumps to mind is the so-called Edwards direction, where there's a case in which the accused person is told lies. There are legal principles that govern the extent to which the jury can use evidence of the accused person lying as evidence of consciousness of guilt. That is, the accused person was lying because he or she knew that they were guilty. Now, the legal principles that you have to direct a jury with respect to that area of the law are very complex, and you have to follow basically the script that's been mandated by the High Court, and if you don't, then an appeal will inevitably succeed. But that script is almost incomprehensible, and I can remember giving such a direction to a jury in Broome, and their eyes glazed over as I went through the mantra that I was required to go through. Shortly after they retired, they came back and said, we'd like you to explain to us what beyond reasonable doubt means. And of course, as you may be aware, the High Court has again told trial judges many times that it's not permissible for them to expand on that expression in any way. So you've just got to tell the jury that it's an ordinary English expression and they must use their knowledge of ordinary English to work out what it means. So this jury said, when I told that to the jury, they looked at me and they thought, why on earth did they bother? I'm sure they were thinking, why on earth did they bother flying you up from Perth? You haven't answered the only question we wanted to ask you, and you've bored us rigid with this all the stuff that we didn't understand and about which we weren't interested. So no, I think there is a case for law reform in relation to simplifying jury directions.
Thank you. In your submission, you note that community standards have evolved to the point that there is a general expectation that reasons will be provided in respect of significant decisions. Do you think reasons should be required in more cases than is currently being done? And if so, will these reasons be publicly available?
Well, I think the short answer to that is where the only area of the justice system in which reasons are not given is in relation to the verdict of the jury. Virtually every other area that I can think of, judges, magistrates, everybody gives reasons for their decision. It's an essential part of the process. So there's really no scope, I think, for expanding the duty to give reasons because it's universal, the one outstanding exception being the verdict of a jury.
Sorry. The second reading speech for the bill suggests that an increase in judge-alone trials could save our court's time. Do you agree with that statement? I'm not sure whether you've got anything to add to your previous
comment. Well, I've really covered that. I think it would be, my view is that it'd be time neutral, possibly saving time, possibly not. But I think there are bigger issues at stake here, frankly, than dollars and cents in time. I think we've seen over the last 100 or 150 years, reason justice has now become, people have a very well-established expectation that significant decisions that are made with respect to them will become accompanied by reasons. In a serious criminal trial, that is probably the most important decision that will ever be made in respect of a person in their life. And it's made under the current circumstances without reasons. So if an accused person wants to have reasoned justice, frankly, if you did the dollars and cents and came out, as I said earlier, I don't think the change that this bill proposes will occasion a revolution in the extent of trials by judge alone. Even if there is a small increase, and even if that does cost a little bit more, and I wouldn't put it any higher than that, in the overall cost of the justice system, I would think that cost would be well and truly justified because of the advantages to which I've referred.
Chair, can I jump in here? It's Nick Coran. Mr. Martin,
yes, sir.
I have a lot of sympathy for what you've just said there with respect to the accused's desire for reasons as to why they might have been convicted. And if they want those reasons by way of a judge providing it, rather than not receiving any reasons by virtue of a jury decision, then they should have that. I have some sympathy for that. I guess I'm also minded by the fact that presently in Western Australia, under our current system, unlike in Victoria, Tasmania and the Northern Territory, an accused can apply for a judge alone trial and obtain those reasons, albeit that it does require a test to be satisfied, which is that it's in the interest of justice. I wonder if you've got a view with regard to the desire of victims for reasoned justice, because certainly I can understand from the accused's perspective, but I can imagine there'd be many victims who'd like to have reasons for the decision one way or another.
Well, I think many victims would like reasons. I'm sure there are a lot of... obviously, it's the case where there is an acquittal or a conviction of a lesser charge that causes the victim's concern. In those circumstances, I think it would be enormously helpful for victims to understand just why that decision was arrived at. They, like everybody else, met with the opacity and inscrutability of the jury verdict, and they're left shaking their heads and wondering why. And that's, again, I think part of the point I was making earlier about improvements in the integrity of the justice system created by the provision of reasons, where an accused person wants them.
Yes. That we received some evidence or a submission or we had a hearing with former District Court Judge McCann, I think it was from memory, and he made a proposal that juries provide some form of reasons for decision. Do you have any comment on that?
Oh, look, I just think that's unworkable with great respect to former Judge McCann. I think it would be too onerous, a burden on a jury at the end of a long trial to require them to produce reasons. And I think it would be fraught with the risk that if the jury misexpressed themselves, there would be an appeal brought on that basis. I've read a lot of questions from juries in the course of my judicial career, and they're often pretty hard to understand, to be frank, so that the 12 people off the street collectively expressing a view, I'm sure this committee's had experience of drafting by committee. It's not an easy task.
In fact, you can have scenarios where people can agree, but for different reasons.
Indeed. So what do you do then? Do you have 12 different reasons, or do you have three different reasons, or, do you put people in groups? I just think that would really extend, that would add a lot of time to the process, I think, and create, it'd be most undesirable, I think.
Thank you.
This is Aaron Stonehouse here. Can I just jump in? Just on that topic, the suggestion, as the Honourable Nick O'Rahn stated, the suggestion was made that juries may give reasons, but through previous hearings, the committee's heard that it is possible for a trial judge to request a jury to make some kind of finding of fact that is supplemental to their otherwise finding of guilt or otherwise. I don't recall the exact word used to describe that. But perhaps you're familiar with that.
It's called a special verdict. So that if, for example, there are two paths to a conviction for murder, as there can be, one based on intent, the other based on the actions, a judge can ask the jury to identify which of the paths they've taken. And so you would then ask the jury a specific question. But you don't get reasons. All you get is an answer. Just did you go down this path? Yes, we did. So it doesn't expand the reasoning process aside from identifying the particular path that has been chosen. But there's no enunciation of the process of reasoning used to arrive at that conclusion.
Can you comment on the prevalence of special verdicts and? And if you have a view that if they were used more frequently, would they alleviate some of the difficulties of jury verdicts?
They're very rare. I think I saw a special verdict once in 12 years, and I don't think they would alleviate the difficulty with jury trials. It's very common now for judges to give juries what we call decision trees, which helps the process of decision making. So that, for example, in a complex homicide, there are a number of where you've got a number of alternative counts. You've got manslaughter, sometimes dangerous driving death. You give them a, and if you've got self-defense is an issue, self-defense is a complex legal area, so you'll often give a jury a decision tree in that area. So you give the jury the structure, if you like, the logical structure that they need to go through to reason their way to a conclusion. But in the end, all you ask from them is their conclusion. And I think that's the best way of doing it, frankly. And I don't, special verdict's just going to complicate things. There are a limited number of cases in which they would be able to apply either, because often the question is, did the accused person do it or didn't they? And there's no way you can split that down into special verdicts.
I'm going to pull us back to our questioning just by returning to the theme that the Honourable Nick Goran took up about impact on victims. I wonder if I could ask you, Mr. Martin, about the requirement for judges to prepare reasons is obviously likely to impact on victims. And we've talked about the fact that it might be helpful in the victim's understanding of the decision, but is there also, or have you contemplated the possibility of a when a victim's evidence is being publicly critiqued, it's likely to cause more trauma to the victim?
Oh, there is that possibility. Very often in that circumstance, the judge would take steps to mitigate that trauma by not identifying the victim by name. So obviously the judge would be alive to the proposition that we don't want to discourage people from notifying police that offences have been committed by them being damaged through the trial process. So you would ordinarily, if there is going to be strong criticism of an alleged victim, you would often take steps to diminish that harm by anonymising that portion of the reasons.
And the second question relating to that topic is that during the trial, severely limiting bail conditions are placed on an accused if a verdict, but if a verdict were reserved for more than a short period, it may be impractical for these conditions to continue. We received a submission that this issue does not currently often arise in trial by judge alone due to the type of trial in which such an order is generally made. Do you have a view on this?
Yes, I agree with that submission. It's not an issue that would commonly arise. One of the reasons for, the main reason for very tight bail conditions on accused persons during jury trials is so that they don't make any accidental, have any accidental impact with the jurors. And that's obviously not a problem in a trial by judge alone. So I don't think there are any greater problems in relation to bail issues with trial by judge alone. In fact, to the contrary, there are bigger problems with bail and trial by jury, especially in country towns.
Indeed. I'm just going to go back to our numbered line of questioning now. Yep. I'm going to ask you a slightly different version of question 14 in the light of some of the responses that you've given us. So if I can just rephrase that question. So in your submission, you note that judge alone trials can be conducted more efficiently than jury trials. This morning, you specifically mentioned the increased speed at which evidence can be presented in a trial by judge alone. However, we've also received evidence from the DPP that dispensing with the formalities of a jury trial can reduce the transparency of the system to the general public. So, for example, handing up evidence in documentary form would not be visible to the public. In your view, can the increased efficiency of trial by judge alone be a double-edged sword by reducing transparency of the system?
Look, I don't think it reduces transparency at all. In fact, with respect to the DPP, I think it significantly enhances transparency because the most important part of the process is the decision. And at the moment, the decision is entirely opaque and inscrutable. Whereas with trial by judge alone, the reasons are published and they can be reviewed by the world at large or by those with an interest in the case. In relation to the trial itself, I don't know if you've sat at the back of a courtroom while a trial is being conducted. but it's often very hard to follow, even in a jury, even if the jury is present. And in real terms, in terms of public access to trials, it's usually through the media. I mean, the reality is, although the courts are open to the public, only a handful of people go and sit in courtrooms. Most of the people gather their information about trials from media reports of those trials. In cases in which, and I mentioned the Rainey case earlier, in the case in which hundreds of witness statements are handed up, the judge would invariably make those statements available to the media because they're part of the court record, and if there had been a jury, they would have been read to the jury. And so the media get access to those and can report anything that's in those statements. So with respect, I don't, in practical terms, I think there is a very significant improvement in transparency in trials by judge alone and no significant detriment.
Thank you. I'm conscious of the fact that we're technically out of time. Mr. Martin, are you happy to go for another 10 minutes?
I've got a little more time, yeah, sure.
Okay, so I think we might keep going, but hopefully not more than about 10 minutes.
Yep,
in your submission, you state that, on a quote, if an accused wishes to forego the right to trial by jury, he or she should be permitted to do so. Do you mean that you think the wishes of the accused should be given priority over other considerations?
Well, I guess what I wouldn't put it quite in those terms. What I would say is, I guess, repeat what I said earlier, and that is, if an accused person wants reasoned justice, that seems to me to be a very powerful consideration in favour of giving the accused person that entitlement. We often talk about people having a right to trial by jury, and that's conventional wisdom. But if a person doesn't want trial by jury and wants instead to have reasons for perhaps the most important decision that will ever be made about them, that seems to me to be a very significant consideration in favour of giving that person what they want. This might be a convenient time for me to refer to one of the other questions that was posed in the materials I saw, and that is, should that right, the right of election, if you like, be complete? In other words, should the bill currently preserve the capacity for a court to say that notwithstanding the election of the accused, there can be circumstances in which the interests of justice require that there should be trial by jury? I think there are circumstances, very limited, in which that might be the case. The sort of circumstance I have in mind is where community standards are involved. So that in decent, under the current law, some of those areas where community standards are involved are mentioned, so that in decency and obscenity. However, the practical reality is that there are almost no cases involving indecency and obscenity these days. Very few of them make their way to the jury. In that area of the law, virtually all the cases involve child pornography. There's no question of community standards there because the images are invariably gross and repulsive and offensive to any sense of community standard. So there's no need to have a community assessment in that area. The one area where it does arise, where there are community standards, I can give you an example, is in the boundaries between some of our offences. So that, for example, somebody can be charged with manslaughter, where death arises from the use of a motor vehicle. An alternative verdict in those circumstances is dangerous driving causing death, an offence contrary to the Road Traffic Act. The boundary between those two offences is very grey, and it's really one of impression, and it's based on the view that one takes about the culpability or seriousness, if you like, of the negligent driving. I had a case, members of the committee might be familiar with it, a case involving a young boy in Kalgoorlie who was riding a stolen motorcycle when, he collided with a motor vehicle being driven by the man who was looking for the stolen motorbike. He was charged with manslaughter. He offered to plead guilty to dangerous driving causing death. The whole issue became very contentious publicly. There were allegations of racism. And in the end, that went to trial before a jury over which I presided, and the jury came in with a verdict of dangerous driving causing death rather than manslaughter. There was, again, contention about that verdict, but I think the contention was mitigated to some extent because that was the verdict of a jury, not the verdict of a judge. And I think that was a case in which which the difference between manslaughter and dangerous driving causing death is really one of impression based upon the culpability of the accused person's conduct. And that's a case in which I think it was important for the justice system that that decision be made by a jury. But if I put myself back in the shoes I was in then, and if there'd been an application for trial by judge alone, I think I would have ruled against it on the basis that it was the type of case that should be decided by a jury. But those sort of cases, I think, are very, very rare, but they do exist, which is why I favour the retention, if you like, of that discretion.
Thank you. Those interest of justice questions are 19 and 20. Do you have anything to add?
I think if you like, the safety valve should remain there to cover the type of case that I've mentioned. But I think the bill, if passed, would make it clear that the default position is if a person elects trial by judge alone, that election prevails unless there's a good reason otherwise. And I think that to me is the right balance.
Thank you. Can I jump now to question 25? Some submissions to the committee referred to the idea that jury trials facilitate democratic participation in the administration of justice. However, others have noted that jury trials lack transparency and are inconsistent with contemporary expectations of reasoned justice. In the light of these differing opinions, to what extent do you think jury trials are necessary to facilitate community confidence in the criminal justice system?
Well, I think the answer to this question is that both of those propositions are right. Jury trials do facilitate democratic participation in the administration of justice, but jury trials also lack transparency in the sense that they don't provide reasons for their decision, and that's inconsistent with contemporary expectations. I think the right... Both of the propositions are correct. What you therefore need, I think, is a balancing and of those competing considerations. And I think the balance that would be struck by this bill is right, so that people who want to have trial by jury can have the trial by jury, as is the long-standing expectation in our community. But on the other hand, people who want reasoned justice should be given the right to elect in all but the most exceptional circumstances. So I think the bill strikes the right balance between those competing but correct views.
Thank you. The submissions prepared for us by the Chief Judge note that the law in the ACT, following a 2011 amendment, do not permit judge-alone trials for some serious offences, such as murder and nearly all sexual offences. In South Australia, it's not permitted for the accused to elect to be tried by judge alone when they're charged with certain minor indictable offences. Do you think it'd be appropriate to limit the right of an accused to apply for trial by judge alone to certain offences?
No, I don't. And you can see, the ACT and South Australia are diametrically opposed. The ACT has said you can't have it in serious offences. South Australia said you can't have it in minor offences. In Western Australia, it's commonly been used and is being used at the moment in the most serious charge in the criminal calendar, in the Edwards trial, and it was used in the Rainey trial. And it was used recently, the verdict this morning, very serious sexual offence trial. I think it should be available wherever the interests of justice, wherever an accused person elects and it's not contrary to the interests of justice. I wouldn't exclude certain categories of offence.
Yes, and you have already touched on the difference in the demographics between those two jurisdictions, which is interesting. My final question for you, Mr. Martin, is that some jurisdictions require the court to be satisfied that an applicant has obtained legal advice before applying for an order for trial by judge alone. In your view, should a similar safeguard be required under the Act?
I don't think so. I think it would be very unusual for an application to be made without legal advice. And in Western Australia, happily, most people charged with serious criminal offences have access to legal advice through our legal aid system if they're unable to afford it. So I think the less barriers to applications, the better. And you say, well, he's been given legal advice. Who was it from? What was the quality of it? I just wouldn't go down that road at all, frankly.
Thank you. I'm now going to open up the floor to any of my colleagues who want to ask additional questions.
Yes, thank you. Chair, it's Nick Goran here. Mr. Martin, thank you for your time with us today. I found it very valuable. Really, thank I just you. Have one final question. I am quite attracted to the way in which you have articulated your position, which is to say if an accused person wants reasoned justice, then they should be entitled to it. My question is, don't they effectively have that already in our state by virtue of the capacity to apply for a judge alone trial and what seems to be very few instances where those applications are rejected? And secondly, this interesting development that you brought to our attention whereby under these COVID corona circumstances that we are experiencing, effectively accused have been invited to make such applications and have decided not to, which we don't cause it, you know, we don't criticise them for that, but I think it's consistent with your statement that if they want reason and justice, then they should be entitled to it. And I guess my question is there really a mischief at the moment in Western Australia that needs fixing?
Well, I think there is, because with respect, I don't accept the factual premise to your question. That, there are a lot of cases in which applications for trial by judge alone have been refused. And as a result of that, those applications are not now made because people know that they would fail. And, I'll give you a couple of examples. Martinez, the case I mentioned, the Walsham case. Application for trial by judge alone for the retrial because of publicity in relation to the first trial. Application refused on the ground that the community would have greater confidence in the verdict of the jury. Well, the jury convicted and the Court of Appeal acquitted. So in the end, there was a trial by three judges, but the difference was that the three judges never saw a witness. And I can't help thinking, frankly, that it would have been better if that application for trial judge alone had been granted. There's the other case I mentioned, LFG, a case in which I sat on the appeal, application for trial by judge alone in a sexual case in which there'd been a ruling that evidence of previous sexual offences would be admitted, a ruling under provisions of the Evidence Act which presume that the admission of previous convictions can have a prejudicial impact. Trial by judge alone refused. And although I would have upheld the appeal on that basis, the two of my colleagues decided otherwise. So trials by judge alone are refused, and the way the legislation has been construed is that there is a default presumption in favour of trial by judge alone that has to be displaced by something significant. And in LFG, the admission of prior sexual offences wasn't considered significant enough. As I said, usually it's displaced by significant adverse pretrial publicity. So if you're an accused person out there and you say, I want reasons, you go to your lawyer and say, I'd like to apply for trial by judge alone. He'd say, well, if you haven't got adverse pretrial publicity or some exceptional circumstance, we're wasting our time making the application because you won't get it. So
yeah,
I think
look, can I just chime in there? I accept that, but I do find it interesting that under these COVID circumstances, people are not applying.
Yeah, well, you'd better check. I mean, I'm going on apocryphal information in relation to that, so you could perhaps follow that up with the Chief Justice and the Chief Judge, but that's my understanding, is that there hasn't been a, despite the invitation from the court, there's been very negligible take-up, which is why I think this bill would be, the bill would make an important statement in terms of the rights of an accused person, but I don't think it would significantly change the legal landscape, if you like, in terms of the number of trials by judge alone as compared to the number of trials by jury.
Okay, and one final supplementary. Is it the case, can you recall when, during your time as Chief Justice, that the court system wouldn't have readily available the number of applications that were rejected for judge alone trials?
I can't recall if we kept stats on that or not.
Okay.
I doubt that we would have, but I just don't know. I just can't recall, I'm afraid.
No worries. Thank you.
Okay. Are there other members with questions? In that case, I might move to close the session, Mr. Martin, by thanking you for attending today.
My pleasure.
For the purposes of the recorders, you can now stop recording.